You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 26, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Jet lag.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, happy Halloween coming up for everyone.
That's true. When this show comes out.
Isn't that too early?
Be 2 days to Halloween.
Yes, Steve and I are on our way to SciCon for a Halloween in New Orleans.
That should be a lot of fun.
Are you guys going to wear costumes?
Apparently.
Yeah, there's a costume contest.
Come on, spill it, guys. What's the costumes?
This will actually go out the day we're at SciCon. Yeah. So.
I was going to go as Dr. Horrible, so I need a mad scientist lab coat, and I found one online, and it's out of stock. Uh-huh.
What, Steve?
You're a doctor.
How do you not have access to
the hundreds
of lab
coats? Do you need a stethoscope, too?
No, the mad scientist lab coat he wears is very different from the medical lab coats that I own.
That's true.
It's actually more like a fencing jacket.
Yeah, that's true. It is different. I would totally win that costume contest.
I don't know. I don't know if my costume is going to get here in time or not. But if it does, I'm going to be Max from Where the Wild Things Are.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, awesome!
I think the movie's been out long enough that not everyone should be dressed as Max anymore. So
that's awesome. That's really
my
cool
plan. Yeah, it's like a spot on costume too,
with the hood and great. The feeties.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about what happens if it gets here after SciCon, and I'm just like, I don't care.
I'll wear it.
I'll wear it, yeah, everywhere I go, so it's fine.
Okay.
I'm gonna try to find a stuffed toy version of
one of the wild
monsters,
things.
And then I'll cut it open, I'll turn it into a purse.
My God.
Oh, awesome.
Evan, tell us about witch hunting.
Because it has to do with this day in science and skepticism. What with witches and costumes and Halloween coming up and all?
What with Halloween coming up and all?
October 29th, 1390. The first trial of witchcraft in Paris takes place, leading to the death of three people. Now, I pulled that single sentence from our friends at Wikipedia, and it turns out in doing a little digging into this Wikipedia fact, it turns out that the trial that had begun on that date was the second trial for witchcraft in Paris, not the first one. And in addition, there were only two people killed as a result.
Damn Wikipedia.
Otherwise, it was accurate.
Not three. Otherwise, hey, that sentence was totally accurate. So, real quick, the first trial actually took place or began on July 30th of 1390 with two women, Margot de la Barre, who was a woman of ill repute with the added repute of possessing magical powers, and another woman, Marion la Dreyorere. And that's the closest I can pronounce this 14th century last name. Marion's husband had left her for another woman, so Marion hired Margot to cast a charm first and then a curse. So the charm was a love charm, hoping that it would save the marriage, but it didn't. So after the charm failed to try to keep the husband around, Margot cast a curse that would make Marion's husband impotent with other women.
Uh-huh.
So upon torture, both of these women confessed to their dealings. Margot admitted to calling upon demonic forces, and the two of them were burned at the stake in late August of 1390.
Well, they deserved it.
Even though they confessed?
That's not fair. If you have to confess, and then, well, it's the only way to clear your soul, Bob.
I see.
And usually, if you confess, though, you get a more merciful death. If you don't confess,
yeah, that's what I was about to say. Like that, at that point, death is that's the good sentence. That's what you want. You don't want to keep getting tortured.
Now wait, but the second trial. Now this is the one that actually began on October 29th of 1390. Wikipedia, take note. And again, this one involved two women, Jeanne de Briges and Massette de Rouilly. Jeanne had a reputation as a diviner, and she had once even been hired by the authorities of a local church to help recover some stolen artifacts from the church. And because she was deemed to have been successful for her efforts, she earned a year in jail for the crime of practicing magic. She was only spared death because she made a promise to never practice magic again. But once she got out of jail, she sort of fell right back into the magic business as it was. Now, the story gets a little bit sketchy because I found two different versions of what happened next. So I'll give them to you real quick. Version one, Massette conspired with Jeanne to cast a love charm on Massette's husband, Hennequin, which resulted in Hennequin asking for Massette's hand in marriage, and the two were wed. However, Hennequin turned out to be not such a great catch after all. Massette did not like the arrangement, so she and Jeanne got together again and performed more mumbo-jumbo on Hennequin that would render him fatally ill. The second version of the story is that Jeanne was summoned to treat the already ill Hennequin upon suspicion that he was suffering from a curse. Due to, of course, his infidelities. Now, it turns out that Massette had admitted to casting the curse on her own, but in both cases, it was reported that all of this was confessed upon...
torture, yeah.
Got it. Torture of the two women, and on August 19th in 1931, they were both burned.
See, women are such troublemakers. That's the lesson here.
The only way to handle a mouthy woman is to burn her at the stake.
Yeah, they need to be singled out, tortured, and then yes. burned. Mm-hmm.
And, it worked for them for quite a while.
And deemed hysterical in the process, just for added salt in the wound.
Well, that's what the uterus is for.
Now, in 1398, a few years later, in reaction partly to these trials, academics from the University of Paris pronounced that magic is real and dangerous. And this contradicted the current doctrine of the church that magic was imaginary. So we have a case of the church being the voice of reason in this particular case, and the academics from the University of Paris saying, yep, magic is real and dangerous. Mm,
brilliant.
What a world that was.
Yeah, right.
Like, who wanted to be?
It's like a crazy world.
It's a madhouse.
Cats and dogs living together.
Total chaos.
I mean, really, medieval times is a brutal, brutal time to have been alive.
But a fun restaurant to visit.
Right.
Yes. Right. You're right. If, as long as you can go home at the end of it all, then I guess it's okay.
The jousting is just amazing. It's all worth it.
I like the chicken.
All right. Well, Bob, tell us about seeing through walls.
It's called a window.
Well, then you wouldn't call it a wall. But MIT?
Excuse me. Window on the wall right there. I'm looking out one right now.
Okay.
All right, but we'll leave it to the pros to tell us how it happens.
To do it the hard way.
Yeah.
Right. MIT has come out with yet another cool piece of tech, a radar system that can see behind walls with no windows involved. Now, it's not yet like making a wall completely transparent, but it is still pretty cool and useful, especially for a first-gen device. And the science behind it, of course, is pretty awesome. Even when you look at people through walls, you can't really get around the basics. And then the basics are essentially that you have to get light to bounce off of something, get that light back to the detectors, and then you have to interpret what you're looking at. Now, like I said, the team at MIT uses radar instead of photons to see the people. The antenna consists of two rows. There's a top row of 8 receivers lined up next to each other. And the bottom row has got 13 units that are used not to receive the radiation, but to transmit the radar. And of course, there's also the associated computer technology and all the other parts to actually to control it and interpret it and do everything. Now, the test performed by MIT didn't go through wood or wallboard. They did a demo using 10 feet of Krell metal.
Oh, yeah.
No, huh? Sorry. Steve, I knew you were going to laugh at that one. Sorry, it was 4 inches and 8 inches of concrete walls. And I guess that's pretty good, too.
Yeah.
Now, you may think that walls would block all the light hitting it. That's kind of like why they call it a wall.
But actually,
yeah, opacity. Actually, walls block only most of the light, meaning that some does actually get through, surprisingly. And in this case, walls, like these concrete walls, block 99% of the radar light that hits it, which actually sounds like I think it would be even more than that. But still, 99%. So then, of course, light gets through. It bounces off of something, reflects off of something, and it's got to come back, and it has to go through the wall again. So again, 99% of that 1% is blocked. So what you have left is pretty much a signal that's weak, and it's really only like 0.0025% of its original strength. So it's pretty attenuated, but so there's not much to work there. But of course, amplifiers these days are cheap and powerful. And surprisingly, that wasn't even the hard part, according to the researcher. To the researchers, the real challenge was developing a system that could provide three key things. They had to have speed, resolution, and range. Without them, it wouldn't be useful for real-time applications, which is the key application they had in mind for this. It was military, of course, but it had to be real-time. Otherwise, these things wouldn't be as key. Now, Gregory Charvat of the technical staff at Lincoln Lab, and he's a leader of the project, he said, if you're in a high-risk combat situation, you don't want one image every 20 minutes. And you don't want to have to stand right next to a potentially dangerous building. So in terms of range, this thing can operate 60 feet from a wall, which is pretty good. I did some Googling around for other devices that can see through walls, and the ones that I came across were these devices that you actually had to hold up to the wall. So I'm not sure if they were real time, but having to hold this up to a dangerous wall obviously wouldn't be good for these urban combat situations.
Bob, as I understand it, those only return one frame every like 20 minutes or something.
Yeah.
So it's not like a real time thing.
Yeah, the ones I saw were actually kind of small too, so it doesn't surprise me that there wasn't much processing power. Now, for the speed, it's real time, which, as I said, is pretty key for lots of these applications. And for resolution, it's claimed to be good as well because of the state of the art digital processing that they do, and they've got all these sophisticated algorithms. So they're saying that the resolution's good. And I'll mention size as well. The size is manageable. They had to kind of balance the size a bit, because if you go with a longer wavelength of radar, then you would your penetration would be a lot better, but the device you would need would have to be way too unwieldy. So I mean, the one they ended up with is still kind of big. Someone's not going to carry it around, but they could mount it on a truck, and that's okay. That's pretty good for that application. So one website described it as big as a grocery cart. So now for the drawbacks, of course. The imaging processing uses what's called the subtraction method. So each new image is compared to the previous to see what the difference is, to see what's changed. Now that means that static objects are essentially invisible. And that's kind of okay too, because even if someone's trying to stand perfectly still, they can still be detected because of all these small involuntary movements that can't really be controlled. Oh, by the way, the frame rate, it was like 10.9 frames per second, which is decent. I mean, it's not your standard 24 frames a second, but it's still decent enough. So, but the real disappointment for me was the image of people that it creates. I mean, they're actually described as blobs. I mean, they just use the word blobs. Now, I guess just knowing that a blob is a person is valuable intel, but I mean, come on, Star Trek wouldn't have a device that sees through walls that only showed a stupid blob. I was kind of disappointed when they described it. And Charvat said that, he said something else that was kind of disappointing too. He said to understand the blob requires a lot of extra training. I mean, what does that even mean? A blob is a person. How much training does that require?
Okay, well, you know, but have you ever seen a sonogram?
Yeah.
That's a blob that, like, you see professionals be like, here's the head and here's the feet, and I couldn't pick out anything. It just looks like
I know.
Mush.
So, yeah. Apparently there's lots of training.
The training is mostly like you see this part at the top of the blob, that's the head.
Right.
This part at the bottom of the blob.
No, I bet you that they're talking more about like what direction it's moving in and things like that, because it's probably very blurry.
Yeah, I guess, Jay, that there's subtleties to the general shape of the blob that could inform you as to what, you know, more precisely what you're looking at, or maybe what the person might have on them, or even how it moves can also potentially provide additional important information. So, but currently they're working on algorithms that can convert this blob into what they're calling a clean symbol. So it's more user friendly. So it's a kind of an easy to identify blob. But the things that I wanted to know at that I couldn't find was, I mean, what would it really take to get a fairly clear image of a person through something like a concrete wall? I mean, what wavelength of light would you need? How big would the device be?
They should just use that new Adobe anti-blur technology.
Yeah, that's great stuff, man. Do you see those before and after pictures?
It's amazing.
Yeah, I can't wait to check
it out.
It
can do anything.
What are you talking about? I don't know.
It's a new anti-blur thing, that like filter that you can do in Photoshop that literally takes like a blurry, out-of-focus picture and puts it into sharp focus.
Recreates it.
There's an amazing example online showing a crowd scene, and the after, you can see everything in the crowd. It's really amazing.
Anyway, like I said, it's a pretty slick device. It seems like it could be very useful, especially in an urban combat situation. And if it saves some lives and helps us take out others, then who am I to argue?
Well, okay, but if you're seeing a blob, how do you know it's not a it's a friendly or a non-friendly?
Yeah, that's right? that's true. I mean, a lot of times,
it's a different color.
I mean, yeah.
Like in video games.
Yeah, the bad guys are red, the good guys are blue.
Guys are green.
No, but maybe
green,
they add in those
green. Don't be silly.
Those cheesy 8-bit sound effects, too. That would be awesome.
Are you guys familiar with Troy Herd Abuse?
Of course.
What do you
Troy Herd Abuse.
He's the guy who won the Ig Nobel Award for making the anti-bear armor. Remember him?
Oh, yeah. He's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that wasn't really worthy of an Ig Nobel. I mean, that was a pretty...
Well, he got it, well, he got it for surviving.
And Ig Nobels, Ig Nobels aren't just given to idiots, you know.
They're cranks,
not,
yeah.
They're not just mean awards. They're for people who do science that makes you laugh and makes you think.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh.
And idiots.
I didn't pick up that stuff.
So Troy claims he has a device that will enable you to see through a wall.
Uh-huh. It's called a drill.
Yeah, and
it's an RPG.
It's called an angel light.
Oh,
and
God.
But he makes it sound like you could see through a wall in visible light as if the wall is not there.
Okay.
Claims he could read, like, he could look through the wall into his garage and read the license plate number.
MIT wants to talk to him.
He has this device, or he has a theory about this device?
No, he says he has a device. He tested it. He did it. But it also he also could knock planes out of the sky with it, too. It shuts down any electronic device. That
within 35,000 feet.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, yeah, you make the plane invisible. The pilots can't see what buttons they're pressing, and it crashes. Sure.
Get back on your medication, pal.
And he says he put his hand in the beam, and he could see like his tendons and his blood vessels as if like the skin were removed. But
invisible
then,
light, huh?
But then,
I think he got whacked around in his bear suit a little too
yeah,
hard.
Yeah, then he started to get some symptoms. And it had negative side effects, so he decided he had to dismantle it.
Ah.
Dismantle it.
Yeah.
So forget the idea that the principles he discovered might be helpful in other things. Let's just take it apart. Let's destroy it.
Yeah. He's like, you know what, guys? I ran out of batteries in my remote, and the only ones left in the house were inside the machine. So, you know,
maybe he's
sorry.
A lucid dreamer or something.
I think he's just nutty. He's clearly off the deep end on this one. And he's like talking about it like, you know, he's going to win the Nobel Prize and change the laws of physics and, you know, how amazing it is. Compare that to the story about the strengths and weaknesses of this new device that Bob was describing. This is real science. This is fake science, you know.
And the real science that Bob is describing is the first generation of whatever's going to come next. Like the first generation of radar that came along, they couldn't tell the difference between planes and flocks of birds, right? There were inherent, you know, limitations, and it'll only get better from here on out. They'll keep working on this.
So what's going through this guy's mind? Is he batty, or is he just knowingly lying for some nefarious purpose? I mean, what's he
thinking? I think he's bat
nut.
Sounds a little delusional.
COVID bat nut.
Yeah. It's COVID fruit bat, or...
Oh, my God. I mean, does he really think people are going to just go along with him and say, oh, yeah, that's so awesome. Here's your,
Bob,
your Nobel Prize.
Because he's cooked out. Yeah, he does.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let's go on. Let's talk about the new anti-malaria vaccine.
Hooray.
You guys hear about this?
By the way, I got vaccinated today.
Proud of you.
Excellent.
My two daughters got vaccinated today as well.
Excellent.
For what?
Flu.
Very good.
Flu vaccine season.
Okay, but you also could have gotten whooping cough, for instance.
Yeah.
Something like that.
No,
there are plenty
like
of vaccines that adults can get on a regular basis.
Yeah, a little booster for
so,
the old chance.
Joe Cohen... from working for GlaxoSmithKline, or GSK, spent the last 24 years trying to develop a vaccine for malaria and finally succeeded.
That's
came up
awesome.
With the vaccine called the RTS-S vaccine, or Mosquirix, like mosquito Mosquirix.
That's terrible.
It's terrible.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
I'd rather RTS.
It sounds like a Batman villain.
Let's stick with RTS. Yeah, right. Or an X-Man or something.
Exactly.
What the hell are you talking about?
I really
about?
Got Evan.
That's awesome. This reduces the risk of developing malaria by 50%.
Nice.
In the trials. It's the largest clinical trials ever conducted in Africa were done on this vaccine. 16,000 children were tested.
And previous to this, I mean, the best efforts I think we've made are just in terms of reducing mosquito populations, right?
Yeah. So interestingly, recently it was also reported that the malaria rate has dropped by 20% worldwide, but that's due to just anti-mosquito efforts, netting, basic stuff.
Netting, and there was a fairly recent breakthrough with scientists breeding mosquitoes that they could let out into the wild, which would then breed with native mosquitoes and render them unable to carry malaria.
Right.
But I don't know if that ever actually came to fruition.
Then there were those giant mutant lizards they released in Africa that eat up the mosquitoes.
And then there were the giant cats to hunt down the giant lizards.
Yeah, they got a little out of control.
It all kind
of
That's yeah, the Australia story, right? Hand. With the toads.
Before you know it, there are elephants running all over the
dogs.
Place.
Dogs. Huge ones. Huge.
But seriously, it's not ready for use yet. They say they could probably roll it out by 2015, but they did complete the first clinical trial and present the data. So this is a tremendous breakthrough. This was a hard problem to solve. It took them a lot longer than he thought it was going to when he first started on the project 24 years ago. But they found a way to interrupt the Plasmodium life cycle and reduce the exposure turning into an actual infection. They're actually hoping to eradicate malaria worldwide. That would be nice. This is one more step. And this
Except
is again
the anti-vax crowds of people. Those
yeah,
people
right.
Will still
they'll do their best to hinder our efforts to eradicate malaria, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Like with the seeing through the walls the technology, this is first gen. But they're hoping that as they continue to work on it, that they'll get the success rate higher and higher. You know, still 50% is a lot. I mean, that's a lot of child and infant deaths that they will be able to prevent with this vaccine.
Glaxo stock went up a full point.
Yeah, not surprised.
The day it was announced.
Not surprised. So, Rebecca, tell us why San Diego is the luckiest city in America.
No malaria.
Yep.
I'm moving there.
For starters.
I hear it's a beautiful city.
So we're going to start with no malaria?
Right. That's what we're leading with. Yes, San Diego is a beautiful city with beautiful weather. However, that's not the reason why it is the luckiest city in the United States, according to Men's Health magazine, which listed America's 100 luckiest towns. And they found this out by looking at a set of qualities for each city. Those qualities included the most lottery and sweepstake winners, the most hole-in-ones on the golf course, the fewest lightning strikes, the least deaths from falling objects, and the lowest debt due to playing the lottery and race betting.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Which, that I find that particular quality to be absolutely baffling, because don't most people who win the lottery end up bankrupt?
Yeah.
Isn't that the
and
usual
wouldn't
story?
That depend a lot on whether or not you have a racetrack in your state or city?
And also, yeah, I mean, to me, like, the biggest thing is how you manage your money. When you play, that's not luck. What happens after that? I don't know. It doesn't really make any sense. So San Diego came on top because of its multiple jackpot winners, low lightning strike count, and low number of lightning related injuries and
skilled
deaths.
Golfers. Apparently.
Apparently.
Well, because the weather's nice so much, you're playing golf constantly, you know. So you have probably more rounds of golf being played on per capita.
Are you saying there were confounding factors in this study? Is that what you're saying?
I refuse to believe that.
I'm saying that the climate had something to do with it.
It's not magical luck?
And the fewest lightning strikes? Well, okay, you know. Jeez, how much lightning rolls through a city that, you know, sees, what, 7 rainy days a year?
It's funny because, yeah, it almost seems as though, yeah, there's more to this than just being luck. But here's the weird thing. So you can kind of see San Diego being on the top of a list like that. It's, you know, supposedly it's a beautiful place to live, and who wouldn't want to stay in beautiful San Diego? Number two luckiest city in the U.S. is Baltimore. Baltimore, Maryland.
I actually lived in Baltimore for 5 years.
Pimlico
did you feel lucky to be living in Baltimore? Is that the main feeling you had?
It wasn't. It wasn't the first word that would pop into my head when I reminisce about Baltimore. No.
It's not. I think if you were to do just a general survey of people within the bounds of Baltimore and just asked them, you know, do you feel lucky? They would probably run because they would think that you're about to shoot them.
Yeah, like, well, punk, do you feel lucky?
Not that I don't love, you know, I grew up in South Jersey. I spent some time in Baltimore going to the ball games and stuff. But dear Lord, Baltimore, come on. Number three is Phoenix, Arizona, which
it's an up-and-coming city growing very quickly.
I like Phoenix.
Okay.
Wow, they actually graded these cities A through F, A plus through F.
Number four, Wilmington, Delaware.
Delaware has a very low tax rate, very low corporate taxes.
It does.
People go there to open businesses to.
And it has zero sales, 0% sales tax, so it is the home of tax-free shopping. And yeah, I have family who live there. I'm not sure how lucky they feel to be living in beautiful Delaware.
They're lucky because they're not living over the river and the bridge in Camden, New Jersey.
Hey now. Hey.
I'm sorry. Any listeners in Camden, I'm sorry. But
never besmirch the good name of South Jersey.
Jersey?
Okay.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
No, I'm just kidding. I have no allegiance to New Jersey. Number seven is Las Vegas. Number seven, luckiest city in the U.S., which is idiotic. Considering that Las Vegas is built upon the dashed dreams of unlucky people.
That's got to be a joke.
They didn't include casino losings or winnings, though, in their calculations. Just racetrack losses.
Yeah, so, you know, it's not really the most scientific list, but I found it interesting. MSNBC printed a press release that had this quote from the editor of the magazine. Luck is basically our modern world's magic, said David Zinchenko, editor in chief of the magazine. People need to believe in luck because it allows them to give a name to the randomness of life. And when you name something, you have more power over it. For a minute there, he was actually on track.
He was. I mean, I think you just add, you have the illusion of more power over it. Fine.
Exactly.
Fine. Maybe that's what he meant. That's what he meant. If we're being generous.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go with that.
Since you've been trashing some cities throughout America, maybe we could be generous at the end of this.
It's true. Good point.
And also, I noticed Loserville is nowhere to be found on this list.
So Quittersburg and Loserville. But this is just a giant exercise in just dredging data for clumpiness.
Clumpiness.
Yeah. I mean,
no, you're right. They're looking for patterns.
Yeah.
It's worse than that, I think, because they don't need to find any patterns, really. It's kind of like our problem with The One, you know, psychic, the show where they try to find the world's best psychic. You know, at the end of the show, they're going to find the world's best psychic because they've determined that they will. You know, it doesn't matter if the person is any good at it. It's just that that person happens to be better than everyone else at the test they give.
The world's least horrible psychic, right?
Right. And it's the same thing with this. They've set out to
some city had to be on top.
City is lucky. Yeah. Which city is luckiest? That one. Okay. Does that mean that the residents are actually lucky? No.
I bet you they got a nice bell curve, you know, in terms of these variables. Mm. Someone had to be at the end.
Yeah.
Bell curves are so unnatural.
All right, well, just a couple of quick ones left. Jay, tell us about the Very Large Array. Big changes coming.
The Very Large Array, or the VLA, is...
Or the VLA, as I like to call it.
You guys have definitely seen it. It's been in movies. It's a, you know, it's one they use a lot in news items whenever they talk about radio telescopes. This one is located in New Mexico in the United States. There's 27 of those radio... those wacky giant radio arrays.
The telescopes.
They're really cool looking. And if you guys remember, these are the ones that were used in the movie Contact.
Oh, yeah.
So the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, who runs the facility, decided that they wanted to update the electronics because when the array was built in the 70s, the electronics were the original electronics, you know. So we're going back you know, what do we, you know, 30 years. It's, you know, things have progressed a little bit since then. So they decided to do a massive overhaul. It took them 10 years to just update the electronics. They weren't really updating the actual telescopes themselves because they do a fine job of collecting information. It's just being able to take the information, process it, do the things that they need to do to sift through it and everything. They updated their computers and everything. It was actually a very extensive update that they did. And the array is actually now 10 times more powerful, an order of magnitude more powerful than it was in
the
70s.
Which is it, 10 times or an order of magnitude?
Exactly, yes. The reason why this is in the news is because not only did they update it and they finished the update and they're all very excited about it, but they want a new name for it. And that's where people like us, the geeks of the world, come in, because we, the general public, get to actually submit a name on their website. Which I think is awesome that they're opening this up to the public. So you could go to nametheArray.org, and you just have to give them your email address, and you can submit your name, your idea that you came up with. Now, I'm not sure if you can do more than one. It didn't say that you could or couldn't. I'm going to put in as many as I can think of. Actually, I have one.
But also, we're going to have our own contest, right? So we're going to have our listeners send us their suggested name.
Yeah, so we'll announce the names that we like best.
And we'll submit it, too.
Well, I think the people
not that they couldn't do it themselves.
Yeah, they should submit the name themselves before they send it and before we read it online, so they get credit for it. But I did come up with a name that I like, and I'll tell you guys if you're interested.
No. Sure. Oh yes,
the SGU Observatory.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're going to go for that one.
No, I actually came up with Mag-10 Observer.
That's not bad.
Mag-10 magnitude 10. No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but it's not 10 magnitudes.
It's 10 times better than it was.
Okay.
How about Magnum?
How about the Magnum one. PI Observatory?
Blue Steel.
Blue steel.
Oh, no. Here we go.
I got one.
HAL 9000.
The Argus Array. What's that from?
Oh, that's a Star Trek.
And then, yeah, it was a next-gen... It was a next-gen episode, one of my favorite episodes, the Argus Array.
All right, well listen, the director of the NRAO, Fred Lowe, said, "We want a name that reflects this dramatically new status. The new name should clearly reflect the VLA's leading role in the future of astronomy while honoring its multitude of past achievements."
All righty. All right, I like Blue Steel.
Not there.
It's not blue.
So, Evan, how did Harold Camping's latest Doomsday prediction turn out for him?
It went perfectly. His batting average is fully intact. He is 100% perfect when it comes to predictions about Doomsday.
Yeah, I didn't want to spoil his perfect record of being wrong.
For those of you who don't know, our dear friend Harold Camping, a preacher and biblical scholar and engineer, told us back in May that, or said as May was approaching of this year, that May 21st was going to be the end of the world. And when that didn't happen, it was, oops, well, his math wasn't exactly correct.
No,
it was
actually the day
of judgment, yes.
Yeah, he always said that, to be fair. He always said May 21st was going to be the judgment, and then October 21st was going to be the end of the world. In between, though, there would be basically hell on earth. There'd be earthquakes.
Gotcha, yes.
So then he concluded that May 21st was just a spiritual judgment, which was indistinguishable from nothing happening.
Indistinguishable, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Look, he did predict, Steve, that earthquakes were going to happen that day on May 21st.
Oh, yeah. He was wrong about that, and that's what he revised.
Do you know what he said about the earthquakes, actually? He said that they'd apparently come in the form of manquakes, since mankind shook with fear from the rapture, and the book of Genesis describes man as made from dirt. Ah, see that?
Okay. So now October 21st, though, was supposed to be no matter what else happened.
That's right.
That was the ultimate final end of the world, gonzo.
Yep.
And
well, to quote Camping, he said, "We will be people will be annihilated together with the whole physical world on October 21st, 2011. Now, there's not much ambiguity there, I'd say. I mean, that's pretty definitive. Yeah.
But I also read somewhere that he said approximately.
He started backpedaling significantly, saying things like maybe, probably, approximately, in a month or so. He also said it's going to be really low-key, very quiet. People are going to quietly just pass away. while the believers quietly ascend into heaven. No fanfare or horsemen or whatever.
Yeah, but what about the whole book of Revelation? I mean, I want to, you know, trumpets, and I want to see people's faces melting off.
Well, people, I think his followers' faces all melted when, in preparation for the May 21st, they were selling all their possessions and buying advertising space and ruining their lives, basically, based on that May 21st prediction.
So, Evan, what's he saying now that the world is still here?
He apparently sent an email out to some of his followers, which leaked out, of course, onto the internet. And here's what his email had to say. Seeing it is now clear that the Lord did not return on October 21st, we are left with two possible conclusions. Number one, the biblical calendar of history discovered about 40 years ago is incorrect in some way. Number two, the biblical calendar of history is correct, but we are missing some additional information.
Number three, I am a hopeless fraud. You didn't include that one.
He omitted that last one. I can't explain exactly why, though. Two possible conclusions. Only two.
Only two.
You can only have two.
Well, sorry, you know, to sum it up, sorry, you're wrong. You've been wrong two times.
12.
I'm dying for him
this
to pick it.
12. I wanted another date. Prediction.
According to some of his followers.
Two times this year.
Yeah, two times this year.
But I hope he does it again.
Jay, right. This might cheer you up, and I'm hoping this will also cheer up some other followers of this story and maybe Harold himself. I wrote a little limerick to kind of sum up the occasion. There once was an eschatologist named Camping. Those he swindled, their feet were all stamping. Mad as hell that he'd promise, the rapture was upon us. So his story he is now revamping.
That was your haiku?
No, that was a limerick. We went over that.
That was so bad, Steve. It was a loku.
To save me the embarrassment of having said, I wrote a haiku.
Wait, oh, wait, you wrote a limerick.
It was a limerick. Right.
You should actually call that a haiku.
All right. Well, Evan, let's go on to Who's That Noisy?
To remind everyone, we're going to play once again last week's Who's That Noisy?
Ladies and gentlemen, the great Randy.
Okay, so who was that introducing the great Randy?
Well, there were a lot of people who thought that maybe that was Johnny Carson actually saying it from one of Randy's many, many, many appearances on the Johnny Carson show. But no. That was the name of an actor. His name was Peter Lawford. Do you guys remember Peter Lawford?
Oh, yeah.
Member of the Rat Pack. The original Rat Pack.
Yeah.
You know, Sinatra's band of brothers. And Sammy Davis Jr. was thrown in there.
Yeah, baby.
As well. Well, in any case, so that he was in fact referring to, of course, our dear friend James Randi, who was appearing on the show I've Got a Secret when it was hosted by Steve Allen. And this was back in 1965. Randi was on the show. He just performed one of his amazing escapes, handcuffed in a box or some such thing.
What's in the box?
And the audience, as he breaks out of the box with no handcuffs on, they are all applauding. And Peter Lawford says, "Ladies and gentlemen, the great Randy." I think someone forgot to mention to Peter that his stage name was actually the Amazing Randy.
Amazing,
not
great.
The great Randy.
The Fabulous Randy.
It's like
we have to make a point now of introducing Randy with a different, you know, superlative at the beginning. Yeah.
The Unbelievable Randy.
The Hipster Randy.
Who was the guy who got it correct?
From the message boards, from our forums, Dr. Atlantis, a good friend of the show, longtime listener. He was the first one to guess correctly. Congratulations, doctor, if you are a doctor.
Good work. What do you got for this week, Ev?
All right, folks. Put on your thinking caps and listen to this week's Who's That Noisy?
I am your lover. Come to my side. I will open the gate. Your love. Come settle with me. Let us be neighbors to the stars.
I don't know where you come up with these, Evan.
Sometimes listeners send them in, and sometimes I just find them on my own.
Thanks, Evan.
You're welcome. Good luck, everyone.
All right, well, let's go on with our interview. We're sitting here at TAM9 from Outer Space with Banachek. Banachek, welcome back to the Skeptics Guide.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. So, Banachek, I think since we spoke to you last time, you have taken over the JREF Million Dollar Challenge. Tell us how that's going.
I spend more time dealing with emails, voicemails, than I do getting almost anything done.
So it's a secretarial position, is what you're saying.
It's sort of become that. Yeah, I you know, that will change, I'm sure. You know, through as time goes by. But right now, it's just dealing with emails. Sometimes 20, 30 emails with the same individual, just back and forth with little fine details. With before they even want to send in an application that probably won't be filled out properly anyway by the time they get it to me. Just about questions about, well, what about this? What about that? And trying to define what it is that they do.
And remind our audience what the Million Dollar Challenge is.
Million Dollar Challenge. We have $1 million for anybody that can do anything paranormal or supernatural under proper control conditions.
You were mentioning about applicants. So yeah. What's the process they have to go through?
That's been changed. That is something that I have accomplished this year. In the past, they had to send in multiple things in order to apply. They had to send in an affidavit it wasn't really defined fully exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit open to interpretation. What I've done is I've made it either or. They also had to send in a media presence. They had to be in the media. Mm-hmm. And part of that, I think, was to weed out. Sometimes you get people a little bit mentally challenged, and we want to try to weed some of that. We don't want to be seen ever that we're taking advantage of those type of people. And that did weed some of that out. It also gave the people that were applying a bit of a responsibility. They had mm-hmm. to follow some sort of a process before they couldn't just say, hey, I want to take the challenge and show up. I did change it because I wanted to make it a little bit more open, a little bit more easy for people to mm-hmm. apply, because that is what we've been accused of many times, of making it too difficult for people to apply.
And are you regretting that now?
No, I'm not, because they still have a responsibility. Some of those things are in place, but rather than having to send in multiple things, it's an either-or thing. And I've added a third selection that we become judge and jury on, but they know that. But it certainly makes it easier, because some people in other countries, they have a difficult time getting things, say, notarized. Some people just don't have the media presence, but they may get somebody else that's serious that might be in a university or college, or maybe able to get a doctor to write a letter for them saying, look, this should be studied. So, you know, they can either send in the affidavit, or they can show us that they have media presence. By media presence, that doesn't mean a YouTube clip or something like that. It means you were in a book. It means you were on a TV show. It means that you've had a magazine article written about you in a decent magazine, not just like the little local neighborhood school magazine or something like that. And then the third one is you can send in a video. What that allows us to do is to take a look at the video. We can sort of judge a person to a point on the video, but we can take a look at the claim. We can clearly see what the claim is. Sometimes, you know, once in a while you might get a video where you can't, you go, well, what is it? I still don't understand. But in most cases, you can understand what it is. It also gives us a teaching tool to be able to put up on the website at a later date. With the video, it's kind of like the worst one for you to send in, because we become judge and jury on it. And we also do not have to let you know why we've rejected you. Mm-hmm. On the other hand,
because you don't want to have to tell people you just had those crazy eyes and we just didn't want to.
Yeah, I could go back and say, look, I need you to get, I need you to be certified by a doctor. I could go back and say, which I probably would not, but I could go back and say, some people would think that claim is crazy, and we just want to make sure that a doctor says that it's okay. I don't think I would ever do that. But if you get rejected on the video, I personally, at least right now, I will allow you to still go back and send me some other type of media.
Yeah, it's without prejudice, so they can meet the other criteria.
Yes, exactly. They can still send those things in. The other thing that we've discussed, and it's been discussed before I even came along, was going after psychics and having specific challenge, a catalog of tests that they could take. The problem with that has always been, as Randy has said, is that once a psychic takes one of those tests, they're going to say, well, this is not what I normally do. They will always say that. But you get people, like we just had Nightline a couple of weeks ago call us and said they want to do a $1 million challenge. Now, Stephen, I've asked you to take a look at a few things, and you realize now, you probably did before, but even more so, the back and forth that goes on with one applicant. That can take up to a year, maybe even 2 years at times.
We've actually done a few of the preliminary tests for the Randy Challenge years ago. I mean, just as our local group, we would test local claims. And so we've been through the process a little bit
before. And it can be a long process.
But yeah, this was a little bit more elaborate. Absolutely, you have to... Because we were talking before we started the interview, it begins with a claim like I could do this power anywhere, anytime, and then when you start to say okay, let's hammer out a protocol, then they start to bring in all the restrictions. Well, it only works under these conditions, and I need this condition. So that process is.
And it can even get to the point where you think you've agreed on all the protocol, and then when push comes to shove, oh, I didn't think about this, and they throw one more thing in the mix.
Yeah, all right.
Is that technically special pleading before the fact? Usually we talk about special pleading after somebody has tried and failed.
Yeah, I think it is. I think people start getting a little antsy, and they really start thinking about their own limitations. And sometimes it may be the fact that they've done it under those circumstances, but they just want to be 100% sure if they're going after $1 million that you know everything's in line for them. Mm-hmm. But going back to this other thing, so we get calls from TV stations, and they say, we would like to tape a $1 million challenge next week, and we don't have anybody. So this time, because it was Nightline, we thought – we'll put a catalog of tests together, and we'll try it anyway. We don't think anybody's going to show up, because what they want to do is they want to flyer all the psychic stores in New York City. And most of those people don't want any attention put on them. So we didn't think anybody would show up. But we'd go in. We'd go in the day before. DJ would do a reading for them and talk to them about psychics. I would talk to them, and I might do some of the things that I do. So at least they get something. But we offered this invitational, sort of an MDI, you know, $1 million invitational. And Jamie and I put the catalog of tests together two nights before we went out there. It was very, very last minute, all of this. We had the stats from Chip the night before and some changes on that the day, the morning of, like an hour before we were about to do it. And we kind of made all of the tests work along the same lines. There would be 12 participants, and we made it for astrology, we made it for handwriting analysis, we made it for palm readers. There was a whole list that went down, and the last two that didn't use the 12 subjects was a medium and a clairvoyancy test that we had as well. What we did was we ended up getting 12 individuals who had different zodiac signs. And we got a biography. We asked each of them the same questions. We got a short biography for each one of them. And then we would bring the psychics in, and I would tell them, you know, I would ask them, what's your ability? Oh, my ability is tarot cards. Well, I have this test for you. Let me tell you what the test is. We have 12 individuals, and we have 12 biographies. If you could do you could have them come over. They can cut the cards. Now, they all wore the subjects all wore these big, huge gloves because I didn't want them to see rings, so they would have to use the right hand. I said, you know, they can cut the cards or do whatever it is you need them to do. And then they'll go back to their seat. You'll read the cards. You'll match it up with the biography. Now, you have to hand all 12 back. You can get 4 of them wrong, but you have to get the rest of them right. And these are the questions we had for them up front. Is this within the realm of your abilities? And they would say yes. Is it a fair test? They would say, yes, it is a fair test. And then my next question, because I want to make sure they just weren't going for it after the $1 million, how well do you think you will do? And if they said, oh, I'll do great. Now the responsibility is on them because they're taking that test. Mm-hmm. Even if they come back afterwards and say, well, that's not what I normally do. Well, you're the one who said that it was a fair test. You said that it was in the realm of your capabilities. And we also gave every single one of those people a chance to do a custom test at a later date if they wanted to. If they hem and hawed at any point and they said, well, I don't know how well I'll do, then I would say, well, why are you taking the test? We're not looking for somebody just to try to win $1 million. We're looking for somebody who truly believes that they're psychic, somebody that believes they can beat this test. If you want to do a customized test at a later date, be happy to do that for you. We ended up with 5 people doing these tests, And I've got to tell you, it was really strange for me. We did a living and dead test where there was one envelope that had a dead person, a famous dead person in it, and all the other one had living people in it. And the very first person we did, they hit it right on the first try. And when you've got $1 million, it's not yours, it's on the line. I've got to tell you, my butthole puckered just for one second there. But it was really great. It's amazing the excuses that people come up with. It's amazing to watch them hedge their bets. There was one guy, he went through – we did the living dead. They also had to do that 12 times. That one they could get wrong 3 times. Mm-hmm. On the 4th time that they got it wrong, they were out of the equation. But the one guy, we go through and I'm going through one trial and he's got it wrong. But I've got to show them all the other envelopes. We start from the left, going to the right, and I'm opening them up. Okay, this one's living, this one's living, this one's living, and the one you got is also living. He's already seen that.
Yeah.
And we continue. We've got 2 left on the right-hand side. And what does he do? He knows one of those has to be the dead tip person. So he just kind of nonchalantly, non-verbally, and it's hard to do it on the radio, but he just kind of points at that last envelope and nods his head like and makes a face like, oh, I knew it was that last one if it wasn't the one I want. Luckily, it wasn't. It was the one before that, so I pulled it out, and there's the dead person. And I never let him get – I wasn't mean, but I never let him get away with any of that stuff. I pulled it out, and the last one, the last one that you thought that it might be as well is not it. It's a living person. We had one lady who was absolutely she had a million excuses. She was fantastic, though, because they were allowed to speak and show us the process because it's TV. And she goes through the trial, and the first time it's Elvis Presley, and she knows she knows it's a famous person that's dead. And she says, "I understand why it didn't work, Elvis Presley. I was asking them, 'Are you alive?' And Elvis doesn't like to think that he's dead. He likes to think that his legend goes on, and he wants people to think as if he was alive. So we go through it another time with her, and she gets to a point at the end. She says, 'I think I know what went wrong this time.' She says, 'They're in envelopes. And envelopes are organic material. So the envelope's living, and I'm asking them, are you alive? And the envelope is telling me it's alive.' It was just amazing. And a few of them would be one-off. What I mean by one-off would be to the left or the right of it. And they would go, 'Well, my energy was in that area.' Stop and think for 1 second. That's three envelopes out of 12. That's like one-fourth of a section on that table that they can claim that they had a hit for.
Right.
So it was just – it was a very, very interesting experience of this. But it was a fun experience because now it allows us to take this out there. I don't think the MDI will be a separate challenge. It'll fall underneath the MDC, which is a million-dollar challenge, same as the mechanical claims and things like that. All these things will fall under the million-dollar challenge. But it allows us to do things that we haven't been able to do in the past with the million-dollar challenge.
But did this take place like 1-2 weeks ago?
Took place last week.
So this is the one I applied for because the ABC had an open invitation for people,
that's right.
12 males, to come down and be part of a psychic experiment.
Oh, we didn't know
experiment.
It was you.
Yeah, it was us.
We had no idea.
Why was he rejected?
Oh, that would have been funny if he had shown up.
Did you – I guess this is my question. Were you guys separated from the 12 males that gave their information for this experiment? Was there that separation?
We were not. We were not separated.
So I would have, and they initially chose.
Oh, so you're going to be one of the 12 males.
They initially chose me, and I was ready to come down early the next morning. It was 10 o'clock the night before.
Yeah.
They contacted me back, and they said, "Mr. Bernstein, I'm sorry, we have enough people already, and it was a mistake, and we don't need you to come down." And what I figured happened is that they, at that point, that after they accepted me, they started to Google me and figure out who I was.
No, what happened was Jamie had some names. We only had like three, but they managed. They got most of the people.
So here's a follow up question to that, and then we can move on.
Yeah.
Had I shown up, and we realized that we'd known each other, would you have disqualified?
No, I wouldn't have because the psychics would not. They didn't know your zodiac sign. Even when we did the palms, when we had the palms taken, I didn't know which palms matched up with which person.
So he was going to be a subject.
Jamie did that separately. You would have been a subject.
You would not have been.
You weren't a psychic. You were a subject. You would have been sitting there with these big, huge, humongous work gloves on you, which really gave us some really nice visual things. There was a point where the tarot card had to match up, like I said. And there was a point where Jamie had an index of which palms matched up with which biography, which I did not know because I was conducting the test. And the psychic had to look at the palms, do a reading off that, and go through the biographies and match them up with the biographies. Then at the end, Jamie would read out which palm went with which person. They would get that. And then there came a point where I'd say, "Now, I want you to take a look at the biography. Don't give anything away, but I want you to read the biography in your head and see if it's your biography. Make sure you know whether it's yours or not. On the count of three, if it's your biography, show it to the camera. If it's not, crumple it up into a ball." Now, keep in mind, they've got these humongous work gloves on, so it's very clumsy. And then you go, 1, 2, 3. And it's this great visual of them crumping them up or turning it to the camera. And even the producer, because they were really trying to push us. We knew these things were going to take some time. And they were trying to push, "Can you do less trials? Can you do that?" And just all these things they just don't understand. It's like, no, we've got $1 million on the line here. We're not just going to give it away. But when that moment happened, the producers were, "Yay, that's fantastic. That's wonderful. It was worth sitting here all that time." So, now, on the tarot card reader and the palmistry, they got 1 out of 12, which is pretty much what you would expect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the special pleading that you're describing, the excuses for why they fail and the near misses sure. and everything, I mean, I think that's what they're displaying there is the mechanisms of self-deception. This is how people trick themselves into thinking they have psychic powers in the first place.
Yeah, the host asked all of them as well. She said, does this discourage you? Does this make you think that you don't have any psychic powers? And they went, no, it's not what I normally do. I think if I was to do this over time, I would figure out how to get it, how to succeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. It's always like, oh, I was just one to the left. Or so they're, you know, expanding the probability yeah. of hitting. But that, I think that's the same process they go through to talk themselves into thinking they have psychic powers originally. I don't think they're necessarily disingenuous. I think that they really believe that.
I don't think they are. I think there are times, even when they take advantage of something they see.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. Here's where they thought they were taking advantage of something, but they weren't, because they had already handed numerous biographies back. But I was watching them, and like the lady that's doing the tarot card reading, she's supposed to be reading the cards, right, and matching that up with the biography. But the people are all sitting there, and some of these ask things like, what do you do for a living? And we had like two magicians in there, and there's a doctor and a few other things. And instead of looking at the cards, you see them looking up at the people that are sitting there. Judging who can this go with. And it usually happened when they got down to like the last four or five. But at that point, if you've already got the others wrong, it's not going to help you a whole lot at that point. And I saw that both on the palm reader and the tarot card reader. But I think they both said it themselves afterwards. They said, this is not what I normally do. I usually have to have feedback from the person. Now, when we hear that, we immediately think, okay, that's part of the method.
It's cold reading. Yeah.
For them, they don't think that. They feel that sort of a bonding with a person, a communication with that person. And it allows them to hone in on their ability as to whether they're on the right track or not. Because until they get to know that person, there's no gauge. And once they get on the right track, then they can open up with that person.
Yeah, I suspect that many of these people really do have a power of yeah. sorts, but it's just the power of empathy.
Well, they feel like they have to calibrate with an individual. And, mm-hmm. and okay, it sort of makes sense, I guess. Yeah, I just don't know how you would test that.
Yeah, that's interesting. It reminds me exactly of like with the scientific community's interaction with the alternative medicine community, where they keep saying, you know, we do the standard double-blind placebo-controlled trials, like just like your blinded tests, and they say, well, this is not how I normally practice whatever it is they're practicing. I need the interaction with yeah. the patient. I need to individualize my treatment. It's the exact same thing. They need the placebo effect in order to make their treatment work, because there's no real effect there. It's exactly the same
Here's
thing.
Here's an example, but even though it sounds very different, it's sort of the same thing, that calibration process. Doing the living and dead test, the one lady said, things are happening, I don't quite know what they mean yet. And I said, what do you mean by that? She said, well, when I started doing this, somebody doing this, and you can't see this on the radio, but I'm tapping sort of above my bosom here. And she says, when that happens, I don't really have a bosom per se, but I
Now, the audience has a really interesting mental yeah. picture.
Yeah,
right now.
Exactly, yeah. So, but she was tapping like that yeah. and you know, on her chest, and she said, when I first saw that, I didn't know. It's a symbol, and I had no clue what it meant. And it took a while before I realized when a man's doing that, it means he died of a heart attack. When a woman's doing it, it means she died of breast cancer. And it took me a long time to understand those symbols. And so she has to calibrate that and what she gets. And that was like the living – she said with the living and dead test, over time she feels she could figure it out when she gets these symbols. And there was one point one lady said the dead person was actually five from the left, and she had picked five from the right. Mm-hmm. And she saw it immediately, and she said to me, "Yeah, I was asking them, give me a number, and I didn't know, but I got five, and I just got five from the wrong end." So I said, "Well, I can't tell you what to do, but I can make a suggestion to you, and you take it for whatever you want. I just don't want to interfere with your process, but maybe next time you need to ask and give me a number from the left." And she went, "Oh, that's a fantastic idea."
There you go.
Yeah,
but yeah. People are really good at rationalizing
things.
And it's just sort of almost a psychological experiment in how good can you rationalize your failure, essentially.
I think almost everybody does it on some level.
Yeah.
Well, you know, just superstition a lot of times. When you're watching we were talking about soccer earlier, you know, the women's soccer game. And I can't tell you how many times I've had people say, well, if I sit on this couch, it's good luck. If I sit on that couch, it's bad. They lost because I sat on this couch. And just, these are normal, rational people. Yeah. Or I'm not good luck. I need to leave the room because they were doing well when I wasn't watching it. And sometimes, and I've got to say, there have been even moments where I step out the room and my favorite team moves up and go, oh, I need to go back out the room again so they can do well.
I've thought the same thing sometimes. Yeah. It's weird.
We're in the capital of the world of that kind of thinking.
Magical thinking.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. You look at those people at the slot machines. If they get up for a second and you take their slot machine, they will slap you.
You know what? I understand why. I fully – first time I went to see Penn & Teller at Bally's, I went and I was playing this machine, playing this machine, playing this machine. And I was playing four quarters all the time. And I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. We're in Vegas, so I'll tell the story anyway. And I'm looking – I didn't want to get up from my chair because I put a lot of money into this machine. It's my machine. And but I didn't want to be like the ladies with the pink hair and the cigarettes. It's my machine. So finally I said, all right, I'm going to get up and go get some change. I got up. I went and got some change. I came back, and I was literally about 6 feet away from my machine. And a guy sat down, an English guy. I was like, oh, okay, big deal. He put four quarters in, pulled it on the first try. He won a brand new car and $50,000.
What?
And then he had the audacity to tell the people, I can't have the car because I live in England, so can I just get the money for it?
Oh.
So, yeah, when you talk about those little old ladies, I fully understand why now.
Yeah.
Wow. That's powerful. Psychologically very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Banachek, we certainly look forward to you being in charge of the Million Dollar Challenge, working with you on that. I think it's great to reinvigorate it. I know it kind of was languishing there for a little while.
I still feel like it's a little stagnant right now, and I'm waiting for the website to make its changes with JREF so we can do a lot of things. Once we have that in place, I think it's going to be really exciting. And, you know, we will hopefully talk next year, and there'll be a lot of exciting things that have happened.
Well, we feel good that it's in good hands.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Banachek.
You're more than welcome. And if you want a guy who can detect ghosts with his mustache, I'll bring him along next year. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thanks, guys.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, our host comes up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. But this week, Bob is going to host Science or Fiction.
What?
It's crazy land.
I didn't agree to this.
Okay, guys, are you ready?
We're ready.
Let's do it.
Oh, yeah.
So, number one, research shows that IQ scores change little throughout most of the teen years. Number two, a new study has found that including enough protein in our diets rather than simply cutting calories is the key to curbing appetites and preventing excessive consumption of fats and carbohydrates. And number three, scientists have found a direct link between the number of friends a person has on Facebook and the size of certain brain regions. So I will roll my 20-sided die, and Rebecca goes first.
All right. I'll take these in reverse order. The number of friends corresponds to the size of certain brain regions. Of course, you know, some brain regions, I'm sure, are responsible for more social aspects. So that makes sense to me that one part of your brain being bigger in the social area could want you to have more friends. Including enough protein in our diets is the key to curbing appetites and preventing excessive consumption of fats and carbs. That makes perfect sense to me as well, because I've noticed anecdotally, and I think that I've read this before somewhere, that, for instance, eating a lot of simple carbs like sugar, you'll eat more, you'll crave more, you'll get hungry faster, sooner. So, yeah, the reverse I can see being true. More protein means you'll stay full longer, and consequently, you will eat less. Which leaves us with the idea that IQ scores change little throughout most of the teen years, which I think is total bunk, because, first of all, teens are stupid. That's proven by science. Except for, of course, the teens in our audience and teen skeptic. I think that, why wouldn't IQ scores change? Your brain is changing drastically during that time. And also, you see, for instance, child prodigies eventually, you know, the rest of their class catches up. I think that's the general rule. So I don't see why intelligence couldn't grow or shrink during the teen years, and I feel like that's where it would be most drastic. So I'll say that that one's the fiction.
Is that your final answer?
Yes, it is, sir.
Steve, you're next.
I will also take these in reverse order, follow Rebecca's trend. Scientists have found a direct link between the number of friends a person has on Facebook and the size of certain brain regions. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of these kinds of studies. If you look for differences in the brain, you're going to find them. It's a question of, like, how much, what was your threshold, what were you using to look for it. But I find it very believable this kind of study, you know, would show these kind of things. And I think, so, you know, how social people are is one of those, you know, very dominantly genetic, hardwired things. So I find that very believable. The study about proteins and dieting. I don't, even without believing the actual findings of this study, I believe that a study showed that, because there are studies that show pretty much every relationship between macronutrients and weight loss, depending on how the study's done and who's doing it.
I forgot to add to number two that it was a definitive study.
Too late.
Okay, sorry.
Nice try, Bob.
But it is, you know, there is previous data that proteins are helpful in cutting calories or cutting the appetite, at least short term. That's a sort of a big variable in a study of this. Was this over 3 months, 6 months, a year? Anything up to 6 months, I believe. And then number one, research shows that IQ scores changed little throughout most of the teen years. You know, we used to think that most of the brain spurt was over by the time you were a teenager, but it's actually been known for a while now that the brain is still growing quite a bit, that there's a lot happening in the teenage years in terms of brain development. So I think it's probably a very volatile time in terms of any cognitive thing you choose to measure. So I think that one is the fiction.
Okay, let's see. Jay, you're third. Hurry up.
How you doing, Bob?
All right.
How's science or fiction going for you so far?
No comment.
That's no more dawdling. That's a good try, though. That was a really good try.
I can't imagine how IQ scores don't change throughout most of the teen years. I mean, teen years, 13 to 19, that's a long time, and a lot of time that, you know, the brain changes and there's a lot of studying going on, and you know, for most people, that one's the fiction.
But keep in mind, IQ scores are relative.
Settle down.
Steve.
That's all you got, Jay?
I mean, I Steve and Rebecca pretty much covered it. I'm just saying that that's it.
Okay, Evan.
Oh, my gosh. You expect me to add to this?
What do you got, Evan?
What the neurologist has to say about IQ.
GWR. GWR.
Certain brain regions. And
go with Robert.
Diet and health. I mean, really. I have to agree. I'll go with the herd.
Moo.
I'll go with the herd. The IQ one. That's going to be the fix. I'm sorry. But what am I going to... Well, no. Steve's wrong and I'm right.
I've led you all astray again.
Nah, I'm going with the herd. The IQ one is the fiction.
Okay, so who's next? That's it. So,
Elijah.
All right, so I think I shall take it in reverse order as well, but please do not read into that. So number three, scientists have found a direct link between the number of friends a person has on Facebook and the size of certain brain regions, and that one is science.
Yay.
Yeah, this is true. This one is true, and you guys did a good job with it. One thing I thought of is that this raises the possibility that that using online social networks might actually alter our brains, which is a conclusion you can come to. But of course, you can't really know that it does that. Perhaps people that have these denser regions actually are attracted to it for some reason. So it's easy to jump to one conclusion, but you got to understand that there's at least two. The areas of the brain identified are connected to memory, emotional responses, and social interactions. Those are the areas that we're talking about here. The scientists used magnetic resonance imaging on the brains of 125 university students. And luckily, they weren't using them much anyway, so they were available. Now, the researchers found a strong connection between the number of Facebook friends the students had and the amount of gray matter in the following areas: the amygdala, the right superior temporal sulcus, and the left middle temporal gyrus. And there was one more, the right entorhinal cortex. Now, gray matter is a layer of the brain where a lot of the mental processing occurs, and it includes parts of the brain that deal with like muscle control, sensory perception, memory, emotions, and speech. So the part that was interesting was how thick the amygdala's gray matter was. It was also linked to the number of real non-virtual friends that people had. So that was in distinction to the size of the other areas, so that seemed to be directly correlated only to the online fake friends. And this was published recently in the Journal of Proceedings of Royal Society B. So then we go down to number two. Number two was a new study has found that including enough protein in our diets rather than simply cutting calories is the key to curbing appetites and preventing excessive consumption of fats and carbohydrates. And that one is science. Very good, guys. Researchers from the University of Sydney showed recently that people who consume 10% of their calories from protein will snack more often and eat significantly more calories in total than people on a 15% protein diet. Now, this is the first evidence. I didn't know this. This is the first evidence supported directly by science that protein in our diets plays such a key role in our appetite and total food consumption.
But what was the duration of the study?
It was four days, I believe.
Doesn't tell you anything.
Yeah, I know. It wasn't very long. And they also think that this kind of information can help us deal with things like global obesity epidemic. Now, humans...
Not from a four-day study.
No, yeah. The humans have a particularly strong appetite for protein. When the proportion of protein in the diet is low, this appetite can drive excess energy intake. And so this is what Dr. Allison Cosby, who conducted this study with Professor Steve Simpson, says. The researchers found that the test subjects who had a diet of 10% protein consumed 12% more energy over a four-day period than those eating a 15% protein diet. That's pretty much the gist of it. But 70% of that increased energy intake on the lower protein diet was directly attributable to snacking. So that's pretty much where people were just driven to snack in between meals excessively, and it was a significantly more calories that these people consumed. So there's a direct correlation to weight loss if you were trying to take it from that perspective. They then tested people with a 25% protein intake, which is kind of like something you would normally think. All right, if a little is good, it's a lot better. But no, that's not the case. The people that ate 25% of the protein didn't have really any difference compared to the 15% people. So the 15 was pretty much the magic number. So that means that research showing that IQ scores change little throughout most of the teen years is indeed fiction. Now, Steve, I really kind of thought I would get you on that one, because we've talked about this before, about how you're really not people do all these weird things to their kids or their babies, and they think that they're going to make them smarter. But pretty much, your intelligence, your IQ level is pretty much set. So I thought you would kind of mull this one over a little bit more than you did.
It is true, though. I mean, yeah, we sort of approach our maximum IQ, but it is true that there's a lot happening in the teenage years. It makes sense that it would be a pretty volatile time in terms of people would still be shuffling around in terms of where their IQ is going to settle in.
Okay, you bastard. Now, it's like I said, it's been long believed that one's IQ remains pretty static during life, and that was why this one was a little bit of a surprise. The journal Nature reported on this, and they reported on tests on teens that were like 14 years old on average. It took a bunch of teens that were about around 14, and they showed improvement and deterioration 4 years later when they tested the same group, when of course their average age was 18. Now the study seemed pretty small on this one: 19 boys and 14 girls. That seemed kind of low to me.
Yeah, it's a small study.
Yeah. But so they performed brain scans on these kids, and they did in conjunction with the brain scans, they also did verbal and nonverbal IQ tests, and the test showed that a change in verbal IQ of 39% in the teenagers, 21% of them showing a change in spatial reasoning, which they call performance IQ. I hadn't heard of that one before. The findings were interpreted as having greater validity than previous studies, because for the first time, the variations in IQ were correlated with changes in two specific areas of the brain. Now, an increase in verbal IQ corresponded with an increase in the density of part of the motor cortex, which is an area activated during speech. And an increase in nonverbal IQ was correlated with an increase in the density of the anterior cerebellum, and that's an area associated with the movement of the hand. Now, the paper says that the results could be encouraging, to those whose intellectual potential may improve, and a warning that early achievers may not maintain their potential. So
called it.
Yeah, yeah. It can give you a better way to assess and not be so discouraged or conversely encouraged by
or complacent.
Yeah. Yeah, about very high or very low IQs early in life. So good job, guys.
Yeah.
I totally blew
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Bob.
Well,
Thanks, Bob.
It was good, though. I think our listeners probably learned a lot, and there were some good items.
Well, thanks for covering that this week, Bob. Jay, do you got a quote for us?
This is a quote sent in from a listener from Sweden who happens to be 14 years old, and the name is Cal Knutson. And the quote is, "Anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and cultural life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means that my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge." It's an awesome quote.
Yeah, who said that?
That quote was probably written by Isaac Asimov.
Ooh, I've heard of him.
Thank you, Jay. Well, thanks for joining me this week, guys.
Sure.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yes, happy Halloween.
Thank you for happy Halloween, everyone.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.